Well, hey there, Skips and Skipperettes, and welcome back to Tales from the Jungle Cruise. This episode was a long time coming. The author of the Mouse Tales books, David Koenig, has been one of the first guests I wanted to get on the show, and our schedules just really never clicked. He's been a real pivotal character in how the fan base of the resorts have changed and how they get their stories and information about what I like to call backstage magic. We were able to sit down with him for a great 50 minutes, but we were unfortunately next to a pool, and the pickup is a little noisier than we're used to. Having said that, it's an episode I'm very proud of, and it is worth sitting through even for the listening of the background noise. So since the last episode of Tales from the Jungle Cruise, we launched the Jungle Cruise Radio Play. Have you heard it yet? Have you? We love it. We've got episodes 3 and 4 of the radio play coming in the following weeks, and we'll be announcing another Skip Gather for June very soon. Also, make sure you catch Joey and Trevor talk to each other on the Skipcast Network, two of our favorite Skips sharing their insight into the world, and maybe, just maybe, you might learn something. Like, not to ignore the iTunes explicit label, but take a listen. These guys are doing great, funny stuff. We're also the proud producers of Nerd 101, a new show that lets you peek inside the world of nerds to learn about topics that maybe you have no clue about. You can always search that on iTunes as Nerd 101 or Skipcast, as always. So have fun with Episode 2, Season 2 of Tales from the Jungle Cruise, an episode I like to call David Koenig's Pool Party. I just generally do a soft roll and we kind of go into it just from the chatting viewpoint. I want to, before I roll too deeply into it, is Koenig or Koenig?
Koenig. Pretend that O is an A.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar just from, you know.
No one else is. So you would be unique in your...
I would be unique in that?
In your pronunciational skills, yes.
Anyone else who's ever seen Star Trek before would have probably been able to guess that one. But
well, they don't say it on Star Trek.
You don't say it, but I guess I'm a nerd. I've been to conventions.
Okay.
So that falls into that category. So... Dave Koenig is with us. Dave, author of many books on the behind-the-scenes of Disneyland, and now are you, for the website side, are you an editor with the is it Mouse Planet?
Yeah, Mouse Planet. I just do a monthly column for them.
Okay.
I've been doing that since they started back in the pre-DCA days. So.
Yep. Back in almost the pre-internet days.
That's pretty close, right? Yeah. It was one of the first big sites, and now there's podcasts and sites everywhere.
I definitely want to get into the whole how has the internet changed Disney, because I think that's a really fascinating topic. I'm used to the intro-y stuff. Welcome to everyone to Tales from the Jungle Cruise. We're in Season 2, and we've got some fantastico guests. David Koenig is with us. You know, I actually have your first book in hardback.
Wow.
With the dust jacket and everything. So back when people remember what books were.
Yeah, the stone tablet of the...
It's the Rosetta Stone of your writing history. When we started talking about doing the Jungle Cruise series, the basic thing that came out of it was, let's create an oral history. And I will fully admit that a lot of what we did early in the last season of things was influenced very heavily by the books and what you did. Because there are so many fantastic stories about what's happened in the resort over the 55, what are we up to now,
57
years.
Yeah, in another year, or another month or so.
In the 57 years of the resort, I mean, you know, those stories either get preserved and archived either in book format or, you know, internet format. There's a lot of podcasts of Disney experiences and a lot of books that have been written from single person perspectives, but you were kind of the grandfather, godfather of that concept. I mean, what was the
impetus to get you to that point with the books?
Well, first of all, I appreciate how you looked at my hairline when you said grandfather.
I did not. That is a horrible lie.
It was always just back when I first started working on my first book, Mouse Tales, I started in about 1987. And at that time, there was no internet. There was no unofficial talking about Disneyland anywhere. It started as trying to discover all the different interesting behind-the-scenes things about Disneyland that Disney won't tell you. Nowadays, they realize with the internet and everything else, most of their secrets have been played.
Well, there was transparent. I mean, that's the internet's transparency really forced that.
Absolutely. As before, they would not. Club 33 didn't exist. It was and so on. There were no secret tunnels. Those aren't even cast members. That's a real 4 foot, 5 foot tall mouse. I mean, everything was insistent to the press. They would not acknowledge that, even the most mundane of cast member
details,
sure. And so on. It was just supposed to be what happened inside the berm stayed inside the berm, and I was just always curious about that. Not curious enough to actually go through the great effort of applying for a job there and actually having to do it myself. But I went to Cal State Fullerton, Cal State Disneyland, so knew dozens and dozens of cast members. A number of them were Jungle Cruise skippers, and they would tell me the stories of what it was really like to work there, and it was just fascinating to me. And I thought, there's no place you can read about this. I've got to put this down. And so that was you and I. For my first book, I interviewed well over 200 people, and you would not believe how many of them said, you know what, I've been meaning to write this book myself. A couple of them actually, Wally Bogue and several others, said, I'm not going to talk to you because I'm going to keep my stories for my own book. And most of those folks never did write their own book, but it was, it wasn't that unique of an idea, even though it had never been done.
Yeah.
And now, that those types of stories with discussion boards and everything else are out there and mainstream almost.
Well, it's interesting that, definitely in the first book, I think you did a good job of kind of balancing the whole park experience, but I think Jungle definitely had a pretty decent chapter. Did you find that there were a lot of stories that came out of the discussions that were Jungle related just because of the reputation of being the bad boys of the park and, being the pranksters and the tricksters? Was that...
Right. Well, there's a few reasons for that, because if you were to take some sort of mathematical calculation and figure, okay, X percentage are Jungle Cruise stories and X percentage are storybook land stories, Jungle stories are by far well overrepresented mathematically in my books. The reasons being, number one, to me, it's the most interesting attraction in the park.
Sure.
It's the only attraction I can think off the top of my head where the employees are actually encouraged to be irreverent, to slightly step outside of that robotic character that they're fairly expected on most of the other attractions. It's about interaction, it's about having fun, and it's about being a different experience, a more personal experience than just riding on Indiana Jones for the 20th time.
Well, and I think it's always the difficult balance that it's an attraction where there's both performance aspects and the obvious safety and operations aspects, and that Jungle tended to weed out the people who got it fairly quickly because you really had to. One of the have you talked to Sue B?
No.
Sue was the first female skipper.
Really?
In 95, when they changed over and they allowed women to run the Jungle. So she's going to be on the podcast later this season, which I'm excited about. So
excellent.
I'll make sure I get you and her in contact, because she's a great story.
I'd be curious, because they tried that experiment, 2 decades before, and it was an abject failure. They tried. It was certainly ahead of its time to integrate the Jungle in the early 70s, and it broke down and everyone was miserable. It lasted a month or two, and then I guess it was about the mid-90s or so. They tried again, and it took off this time?
Rolled in a couple of years before Narrations.
Okay.
Is when it kind of rolled in, and then Narrations came in. We've had some really good details. How far back have you gone with Jungle? What's the earliest service time with a skipper that you've chatted with?
July of 1955.
Day one?
You know, yeah. There were several people, not too many around anymore, but yeah. Unfortunately. But yeah, I've interviewed skippers from, you know, people who are still there all the way back to the beginning.
Do you find that there's a fondness of the people? I think everyone has a romantic attraction to whatever area of the park that they worked in. I think that's the natural essence of working at Disney, is when the magic rubs off a little bit onto you, that you gain that kind of emotional attraction. You have a pride, and you know, I think it's very fostered, and it's a very smart move on the company's part to get people that invested in what they're doing, because you know, I think it gives a better guest experience. There's better safety elements to that. But I mean, did you find that when you talk to old skippers that we've noticed almost like a fraternity? That, you know, we have skipper groups that we've talked to. There's a skipper group of skips that served in the 80s that are still active on Facebook. There's apparently a group of about 20 skips from the 70s who get together and have a yearly get-together. So, I mean, I think that there's a real camaraderie because of the type of attraction it was. I mean, it was almost Bill Murray and Meatballs at some points.
Right, right, right. Before. Yeah, there, though, you know, there are... It's funny you say that, because for the vast majority, it is... this fond memory for most, but there are a number of old-timers, and I'm sure new-timers as well, who look back on their Jungle Cruise experience as the worst time of their life. Because if you're not a match for Jungle Cruise, and you're forced to spiel constantly, I know a number of folks who were otherwise very good cast members who would purposely do horrible spiels in hopes of being placed somewhere else to show, to prove, you know, this is not where I belong.
Well, and, you know, Jungle really went through, I don't want to say it was a slump, but there was a point, I want to say like late 90s, early aughts, where Jungle started getting this nighttime following of and I think it was the annual pass, when the annual passports really started getting pushed in the late 90s.
Right.
And the early aughts, I hate that term, early 00s, what do we want to call that? But I think that what really pushed Jungle kind of back to prevalence is that nighttime annual pass holder experience. Because you got APs who would come in the park because they could, and it was a much freer experience. And we would have groupies. I mean, we would have people who would come in 2-3 nights a week just to ride Jungle who were locals. And there was a real sense of, we knew people's names and they knew jokes, so we had to kind of vary it up and keep it fresh. And it was a great part of that experience, because at that point, even in the late 90s, attendance was... There were still dead times.
Yeah.
You know, now there's no such thing as a slow part of the season. They've marketed annual passports, and they've marketed Halloween time, and they've marketed all these other areas to make sure the park is always full. So, I mean, that universe doesn't exist anymore. You don't really have that personal, you know, APs coming in and just riding the ride for hours.
Right, yeah. So, I agree.
On the Jungle side, but random question. Do you have a favorite Jungle Cruise joke?
Nope. I don't. My favorite Jungle Cruise joke is the one that I've never heard before. Just absolutely adore... I mean, and I'm sure you've ridden it, obviously, I'm sure more than me, but when I still go on the Jungle Cruise several times a year, and most of the time you'll hear that the same... jokes just done in different order, different delivery and such, but you know, every once in a while you get somebody with a couple original ones, and even if it's not the funniest joke, just that they would go out there and try something different, they get marks.
The original ones are things that we used to call getting called up to the offices. The worst guest compliment you could get working at Jungle was, "I love that skipper. I didn't know a single joke he told." And we would get a phone call saying, "So, which jokes are you telling?" That can be a little dangerous of a feedback. Is when you're good and recognized for being good, that can kind of burn you in the back end. Because I mean, there, and I think it's great when skippers respect the ethos of the Jungle and the spirit of the park, and use it as a platform to be a little creative. I think there's a great opportunity for that. I had a skipper recently, gentleman by the name of Isaac, who I thought was just absolutely fantastic, did almost dead on to the scripted delivery, but he tweaked it in just little fun ways. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's that as well, where it's the delivery of the material makes a big difference. Now, where you were, obviously, you had already started working the books back in 95 when the indie opening and the Jungle Rehab had happened.
Right.
What was your take on where that was going? What was the things you heard from people?
Well, that was in the mid-90s, and it wasn't so much the Indiana Jones makeover, although that gets that was an excuse to shake things up, as much as the management philosophy in the park at that time in the mid-90s. It was, you know, the new management had taken over the Disney company in the mid-80s when I first started working on my first book.
Sure.
And then it came out in 94 and basically was, you know, the history through that. But it hadn't, that new management really hadn't had a huge effect on the day-to-day operations of the theme parks until about 93 or 94.
Mm-hmm.
They were better served messing with the movies and the retail stores and everything else. And except for getting, you know, money to buy new attractions and such like that, there wasn't really that pressure placed on them to be everyone uniform, everyone save a penny here. And that came in about 94, 95. And it created this strange park for a couple of years where it was among the most busy years ever in the park, and to me some of the saddest. I mean, because for many people it was not a fun time to work at Disneyland, especially the Jungle Cruise.
Well, because the squeaky wheels tend to get replaced when you're in situations like that. So
you know,
Jungle tends to be an easy target because, you know, if you go out on a limb a little bit, anytime you take risks with delivery, it can either enjoy people or it can offend people.
Right.
So it tends to be that real delicate balance of that. And I think people find that out really quick when they start working the ride, because their friends and the people they work with will tell them very quick, don't do that joke. You'll hear it once and it'll be like, nope, let's just turn that faucet off quickly, because nobody who's working the attraction wants to see management, or quite honestly, have the standards be lowered, so it makes it difficult for everyone else.
Right. Yeah, because they there would be mistakes made, and everyone would suffer for it. Primarily the guests.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got an unhappy skipper,
oh,
that's 32, 35. How many seats in a boat now?
45.
Oh, the new boats.
It was 48, which oddly enough I think is the same capacity for Trader Sam's Tiki Bar.
That's
the same number of people can fit in a boat as fits in that bar.
Yeah, perhaps the same ones.
And lap sitting.
Sometime, yeah.
Yeah, there's no mini bar. That's part of the mythology, that there is no mini bar in the boats. That little crate in front of the skipper, that's not what it's
What's
there
for. Inside that crate? I must know.
Really? Well, there's a piece of rope that's used for boat-to-boat evacuations to tie boats together, or to tie them off to the dock if need be. There's a fire extinguisher. I don't think I'm spoiling any Disney secrets there. And there's a magical piece of metal that helps guide the boat through the river.
Smith and Wesson?
No. That's just on the hip.
Okay.
That's
all right.
On the front.
All right.
Of the boat.
No, because I remember when they went to the new boats, and
sure,
and that big crate was at Skipper's at the time in 95 was a big bone of contention. There used to be a swiveling stool and you could turn to the guest, and it was much easier to become one with the guest in a sense and work that into your act as opposed to this big cumbersome crate.
Because you really couldn't sit on the crate and still safely operate the boat. It was just far enough away.
Yeah.
And there were a number of skippers of girth, from what I understand.
Yes.
Who were relocated after the boat change because they weren't able. Actually, I know a skipper who was too tall. He was starting to get trained over there. And he is well into his, I want to say like 6'7", 6'8", and was not able to be trained on the attraction because his head was hitting the rails.
Wow.
So in a safety situation, that was a dangerous...
Right.
No, actually, I mean, as we all know, the boats are guided through the river by the spirit of the river. The spirit being a pathway that the boats follow in a spiritual sense. It's attached to the bottom of the river with bolts. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I'm buying that completely.
You're buying that completely.
It's, yeah.
there's a spiritual element that it's not a track, really.
Okay.
By the way, interesting note, you know that how Walt Disney World in Orlando, how their Jungle Cruise differs boat-wise from ours?
Tell me.
They actually have a ravine that's actually in the bottom, and they have a wheel system that just kind of glides along that sunken area, whereas ours actually has a metal rail that the boat's attached to. So you can't have a boat derail in Orlando, which unfortunately in Anaheim is a reality, where if debris gets caught between the rail and the boat guide, you can have the boat derail. And
right. Now, how often does that happen? Because I've heard countless tales of
six shots.
Of the
gun codes. I would say it depends on the season, because when the foliage is falling, when the bamboo is coming down, and there's a lot of debris in the bottom of the river, it can be likely. A lot of it, too, depends on water levels.
Okay.
The jungle will only operate within certain water levels because the boats need to be operated safely. So if the water level gets a little too high, it's a little easier to derail a boat. And then there are certain spots where the speed of the boat going into it could cause issues, and where you don't want to start backing up in the middle of where there's a wave cresting behind you if you're moving the boat too fast. I wouldn't say it's common. It can happen a couple times in a week, or you can go a longer period without it, or you can have a streak of bad luck and just have it hit.
Hmm.
And it really is dependent on the seasonal conditions and a number of factors.
Now, six shots is a derail, is that right?
Six shots is a derail.
What if you're back at the dock and you hear seven shots? What's the course of action?
Well, you wonder why they brought in a Glock instead of the Smith & Wesson, because you'd need the bottom feeding clip to get the extra shot out there.
Okay. What if you get a little gunplay going with two skippers and you hear 14 shots or something?
Then you would be magically transported back to the 70s where someone wouldn't get fired for
that. Oh, okay. All right.
I think people have become so sensitized on the gun issues. I mean, obviously, there was a six-year period where the guns were removed from the jungle. I was part of the air horn brigade, where instead of guns, we had the loud air horns to alert for emergencies. But when the guns came out, there was... It's a lot stricter play with them after, in the 90s. The 70s, maybe the, gun thing would be okay. But, yeah, that's not something that would be accepted under the current political conditions.
Right.
Climate.
Okay, you're on the dock, and you hear the guns.
You hear the
fire.
Six shot.
One, two, three. Does people start calculating? Or what? I mean, I would think at some point.
Oh, yeah. If you hear a six
five?
Shot.
There's not such a thing as five.
Once you get above two, there's an immediate... Once you hear the third one, your brain goes into a different mode.
Okay.
I mean, it's an immediate... Because basically, the three-shot would be something happening where... And once again, this is not a secret. This is readily out there on the internet. Three-shot...
And in good books.
Yeah,
and
in great
too,
books.
Yeah.
The three-shot is boat in distress. Boat can't advance for some reason. Could be a piece of bamboo falls across the pathway. Could be the engine just decides to stop. Could be evil gremlins. I think we might have seen that Walt Disney cartoon from World War II. Where the gremlins actually get into the boat. I don't know if you're familiar with that
I have
one.
Seen that. I haven't seen the Jungle Cruise version movie.
We hope that never happens. I really wish they would have done Goofy as a skipper. The whole, how to be a skipper with Goofy. That would have been great.
That would have been good. Okay, four shots.
So three shots would be boat in distress, boat's not able to move. At that point, every boat stops forward progress.
Okay.
Because you don't want to come around the corner and have a boat there that you can't get around. You just stop and wait for further instructions. That's why there's a radio on the boat for communication with all the other boats and with the dock. Four shots would be a medical issue, and I had that happen once. Have you had my four shot was someone getting stung by a bee who was hyper allergic.
Mm.
And luckily it happened fairly close to the dock. It happened native village area. And,
can you haul them off the boat?
When you do a four shot, when you call it on the radio, it's basically get the heck out of my way.
Okay.
And all the boats that are in front of you will just not even unload guests. They'll just keep going past the dock.
Through. Okay.
Yeah, and we'd come in and literally, this was probably 60 to 90 seconds. And within another 20 seconds of us getting to the dock, Disney Nursing was there. Mm. I mean, they are exceptionally effective at being where they need to be. I mean, they're really a great response group. And then six shots, obviously. And five shots is nothing.
Yeah, well, have you ever heard the elusive five shot?
Well, yeah.
Distress call.
Yeah, five shots is because it's a six shot, but one of the bullets doesn't go. It's
a misfire. Okay. All right.
But you don't want to, you know, as a skipper, you don't want to sit there and put another one in because it takes too long and it's embarrassing. You just act
you
like
yell
that
out,
was
bang.
To
what do you? Yeah. What's number six? Okay.
Yeah, the little flag drops out of the front of the gun after you fire five. But then you would call in on the radio and you know, whatever the situation was. And that, you know, I think every attraction has their operating procedure and their protocols. Jungle, obviously, because you have 50 people, let's say 8 boats on the water, 400 people in motion. There has to be that system for identifying, you know, situations to make sure everyone is properly taken care of and that everything is safe. So,
right.
So, by the way, I'm apologizing to our listeners. We picked a great spot. We actually are by one of the Disneyland pools. So if you hear kids screaming in the background, it has nothing to do with me. I am not in any way, shape, or form causing those children to scream. There is no heads being held underwater. It's funny, Dave. When I was working at the jungle, everyone always used to say that I had the heart of a child, and I kept it in a jar by my bed. Oh. So back to the 90s. That was a different time. I remember going to the park as a guest, and the thing that always struck me was the state of repair during that time period. It was so different than what you imagine it to be. I mean, I think that at that point, the park had become a little run down. There were things like you would see cracks on the monorail trestles that didn't get painted or patched over because of budgetary concerns, because you know, there weren't the number of people coming into the park that they needed, which, you know, they remedied it, you know, in a million different ways later. But, I mean, it was a tight time financially. So I don't think the park repair was as good. And I think that Indy was when the switch got flipped a little bit, because it was such a big, visible attraction, that I really think that they started just, you know, taking better care of the park at that point. Just per my personal opinion. I don't know if that tags along with what you've seen or what your experience is.
No, but okay. It's a good story.
Okay. What's your story?
I don't know. No, I would think that that's when, about the time when they started cutting back on...
Maybe I'm putting it farther
on maintenance. Yeah, it actually
late 90s?
From what I saw, and I interviewed many people in facilities, is that they would try and accomplish even more and more ambitious attractions like Indy with the same or smaller of a staff.
Yeah.
So it actually, while Indy being a new high profile attraction, would get a lot of attention. Some of the older, you know, if you went in the Tiki Room in the late 90s, it was, you know, it was the museum
of
yes, it was a very, very sad place where most of the animatronics were not audio, and you know, except for the clicking, you know, of the few that had
any
movement.
The airlines.
Yeah, exactly. If you've seen a dying animal that can move just one limb, that was the Tiki Room. And so, I mean, while there was money still being spent in some places, it was getting spread, you know, to cover a larger, growing, more complicated park. And at the same time, the company was trying to save money as well. They figured, you know, why does it take 3 people to do this job? Can't we just have one person, you know, do that? And then eventually, after a few years, things started becoming... you know, very noticeably in disrepair.
Sure.
And as they were getting close to the 50th anniversary celebration in 2005, it was about a year and a half before that, they realized the cameras of the world are going to be here, and they're going to really be on the places that are looking run down, such as the jungle. You know, these original attractions that had been there for almost 50 years that hadn't been taken care of quite as
But Jungle had a big facelift in 95. I mean, you know, the new boats, the new boathouse. I think Jungle was in a much better state than a lot of the other parts of the park. I mean, Tomorrowland was the real eyesore before the big, you know, the big, the Rocket Rods remodel.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
And that whole transition there. Tomorrowland was where I really felt like the park was... you know, the most in disrepair, the most...
Right. Well, that came... That looked horrible when they tore that apart out of need for fixing it and updating it in 98. And then they basically left it alone.
Yeah.
And so it deteriorated very quickly. But for the 50th anniversary, they went in and spent a gazillion dollars.
Sure.
shut everything down, redid the jungle yet again, as well as several other original attractions. The Mark Twain was basically rebuilt, and others, just to play to the camera, and as a bonus to us employees and guests, you know, have practically a brand new park. I can't remember a time. 2005 was about as good as that park has ever looked. I know I have this memory that when I was a kid, you know, you would never drop trash on the ground, that it somehow magically dissolved before it ever, or there were sweepers hiding behind trash cans, you know, with their dustpans. But I'm sure it couldn't have been clean.
It's ex-cast members, because even to this day, if I'm walking in the park and I see trash, I still pick it up.
Right.
There's a legion of people who used to work there who still have pride when they're walking around the park. And I think there's little magical Disney fairies that help keep the park clean.
And as well, there's that group that you were talking about, your annual pass holder groupies.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how active they are in this task currently, but I know back in that day, the late 90s and early aughts, where I'd see them picking up the trash. It was like they took this huge ownership of the park, and they became deputized to be cast members.
So what do you think the change was after the 05-06 season? Because I don't see that now. I think the annual pass holder experience is vastly different now. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's necessarily that pride. And maybe it's just the distance from the point where things started changing, mm-hmm. where, you know, there was... I really think that the early 2000s was a glory day for Jungle. 03, 04, for me, was the point... I mean, granted, I was working there, but I mean, it was a point where there was a little bit more relaxation in the scripting, and we had an amazing adventure out there. But every we've talked about this a lot on the podcast. Every generation makes their attractions their own. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as the same summer twice. Which, once again, I think I'm quoting Meatballs. I think I'm actually going into Bill Murray territory there. I don't know. But no, every summer is owned by the people who work for the attraction. And every generation would like to believe that what they're doing is more special or more... I mean, it's just the natural ownership. It's like every senior class graduating from high school believes that they're the penultimate of high school education. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't see that that's there anymore, that pass holder pride in particular.
I think it's because it's a different audience. Now we've got... I mean, back then there were a couple hundred thousand annual pass holders, and it was not as... it was a different breed of person. And most of those people are probably still annual pass holders, but that annual pass holder base has become diluted by the normal people.
They made it too accessible.
And I don't know if it's too accessible, because, I mean,
it's expensive.
It's expensive, but if you've got the amount of money it takes, and you want to spend, you know, once every couple of weeks taking your family after work or after school or on weekends as your local mall instead of Disneyland, you know, before it was this project where the annual pass holder was a special breed of person who, I mean, you'd make fun of somebody back in the late 90s. It was, that guy goes to Disneyland every week. Yep. What's wrong with that guy? And now that's normal. My wife's the school she teaches. There are hundreds of families at the school.
Sure.
They're annual pass holders, and that's just
what you do in California.
Exactly. Well, it's become like going to the beach.
The monthly payment thing, I think, was a big switch on that when they did that a few years ago, that, you know, going to the monthly deductions, and smart for them because they're making a killing on, you know, transaction fees and all the other things. I'm sure they have great negotiation with their banks, and they charge a premium for it, so they're getting even more money for the same, you know, annual pass experience.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I really think, I mean, there was a time, and I think it's hard to remember this, but there were not Disney stores at every mall. You know, in mid-90s was when the explosion of the merchandising and the Disney Afternoon, you know, animated series, you know, the Tailspin and Darkwing Duck and all of those were really coming in the early 90s. And that explosion of branding across all the media outlets changed the way the park was represented. And you once again had what Walt had back in the 50s, where there was a national audience paying attention to the Disney brand in a way that it hadn't for a while. Because there were some not great times before Little Mermaid. you know, as far as the perception of the company and the theme park. Whereas when you moved into, you know, the Little Mermaid generation, it really became a money-making machine. They were able to create a different kind of magic again.
Right. Well, not only that, they had this big storehouse of demand and products built up because the previous philosophy was rationing off the Disney magic. They thought, you can't give somebody too much Disney magic. You'll kill them. They'll die of... Over magication.
It did happen once. I heard that happened.
There is one reported, but he actually did not pass away on Disney property.
Okay.
So they dragged him up over the Knott's Berry Farm state line and said, I don't know, Ghost Rider incident.
That was Knott's Berry funny.
Yes. I have no idea what I was talking about.
It's all right. We were talking about rationing off. I mean, because they were tight with the brand for a while because there was a limited amount of material for them to put out. You know, that was why you saw, I mean, you still see them rationing the DVDs.
Right. Well,
they go in the vault and they come out. I mean, they really controlled the flow of the magic.
Right.
So that people have a, a need for it. It's an addiction. It's a fix.
Right.
They're getting their
fix.
The problem is that it's become so saturated with so many titles and so many things that are happening that there's now almost a backlash again at how over-commercialized Cars has become, or
whatever
it is. And then you have the moments where something like Up comes out and surprises the heck out of everyone and, you know, becomes really a piece of art, you know, beautifully done, that it isn't, you know, something that they can commercialize. Ratatouille was another example. Great movie, nightmare to try to create product for it. You know, cookbooks, I guess.
Right, which is interesting because to me, those best movies don't always end up being the ones that Disney views as best because they're not making as much. They're making much more money off of Cars 2 merchandise than they are of stuffed.
I love
Ratatouilles.
I love the John Lasseter that they're going away from the direct-to-video sequels. I think that's fantastic.
That's a good point.
I think they've made some. I think that they've made decisions that have respected their legacy very well, but that it's. I'm pretty sure that was a child jumping into a pool at some. But they've honored the legacy very well at the same time that they've had to keep the commercialization happening so that the money can flow to keep things operating.
Right, agreed.
So
that's a line.
It's a balancing act. And you're always going to have people who are resistant to... But the kids love it. So there's that. Random things we ask people on the show as we get people on. I mean, do you have an attraction within the park that's your sentimental favorite, whether it's there now or a prior incarnation?
Yes, this is not for kickback, but it's the Jungle Cruise. It's just absolutely because it's so unique, and also because it was there in the beginning, and it is basically the same attraction that it was when I was a kid. Certainly some of the animatronics have changed, and the course of the river has been sliced off a little
bit. The spirit.
But the spirit, and it seems like, especially when I take my glasses off, it seems like the same attraction as when I can relive that same experience. And to me, the busiest time there ever was at Disneyland, their busiest attendance year, was the last year of the Main Street Electrical Parade, when it was glowing away and people were in tears. I don't know if you worked there back then or if it was if you visited, but it was this giant communal experience where, I mean, I remember watching it the last time I saw it. I was surrounded by people from Arizona, people from Northern California, driven out here just to say goodbye to the electrical parade. And to me, I always thought, especially after it came back, this is a good parade, but it's not that good. And I thought what it is it's this...
Yeah, the shared memory.
This shared memories. It's almost the identical experience that you had when you were a kid. And now you could have it with your own kid. You could step back into 1972 Disneyland.
Yeah, no, and there are moments that were like that. I mean, when the Electrical Parade came back, I was working at California Adventure. And there were people who would come and watch it again for the first time and cry.
Yeah.
And I mean, and the funny part of it is, there were maybe 600 or 700 people on that route. There was a very low attendance at the start.
Right.
And the very big spike at the start. But I mean, there were nights where, you know, I think that Pete was riding on top of Elliot and waving at like three people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a rough start to that, and it eventually, you know, continued to create a little bit of buzz, and it worked.
Yeah.
But that parade route was always a difficult sell. I mean, the way that it winds through is always a tough
right.
Because right. it's unlike the Disneyland parade route where it makes there's a linear sense to where it goes and it's a very straight path. The California right. Adventure just kind of takes up the walkway at times.
Yeah, and not only that, the scale of the electrical parade, it's nice to see it coming and sure. see it going. Yep.
It's big. It feels big. It feels like it's an adventure and an experience. And what do you think? I mean, obviously, we're going through a transition with Cars Land coming and Little Mermaid and some of the other things. What do you, if you're to sum it up in a couple words, what do you think the state of the park is right now?
I mean, the state of the resort
state of the resort. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're at a very high time right now, and I don't know if people would. Agree with that necessarily, and I'm not saying it's the best time the park's ever enjoyed, but I mean the upkeep is good, the morale seems pretty good. I mean there have been far worse times in those types of areas. Attendance is high, which is good for Disney, not always good for
the guests,
right? Because it's a different. It took me several years of adjusting, whereas. Realizing, you know what, I can't be an annual pass holder who goes on a Thursday night just to hold hands with my wife and walk down Main Street, look at the flickering lights, and go out to, walk in without a wait and have dinner there. It's a different experience. Crowds are now a permanent attraction at Disneyland. They're not going anywhere.
No, and they have managed, they had to. They couldn't have the seasons where they had 10,000 people a day in the park. It didn't make financial sense for the labor loads.
Right, right.
You have to have these significantly higher numbers. Which one thing I'm not supposed to talk about, legal talk, I'm not supposed to talk about how many people fit in the park, and that's part of my
right.
discussion.
Well, there, and that's another good reason. I know a lot of old-time traditionalists may be resentful toward California Adventure because it stole their old parking lot or whatever their reasons are, but to me, I would like nothing more than to see it be as close to Disneyland in quality as possible, sure. as successful as possible. Take as many of those Disney people out of Disneyland and put them there, and hopefully justify building a third gate so that we can, instead of having 80,000 people trying to cram themselves into Disneyland, yep. it could grow to 90,000 and 100,000 people spread amongst two and three parks.
I actually think, I like California Adventure. There are things that have come and gone that I'm sad are gone. Hollywood and Dine, I think having that gone was a huge mistake. I don't know their receipts and revenues on it, but that was the best food of the park for a long time. I was around in the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire times and all the things they've done. Of course you're going to have a transition. The story I always used to tell people when I was, I'd moved over to Disneyland, and California Adventure was still so new that not a lot of people had gone to it. And I would get asked, oh, what do you think? Is it good or is it bad? I said, it's like any other two-year-old. You have your moments where you love it, and you have your moments where you want to strangle it. And, there were ugly times where you had to clean up vomit, and there's great times where they have that great smile on their face. It's like any other two-year-old. And as it matures and as it grows, I think that it's gaining a polish and gaining, its sense of who it is. I think the same people who griped about California Adventure would have griped about how Disneyland was in the first 4 or 5 years of operation. I think if you compare the caliber of the operation to what it was back then, of course, I think it's operated very professionally with a great, feel to it. But you're going to have duds. You're going to have things that don't make sense. I want to hit, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and there's a couple other topics I want to hit. What's your take on the biggest controversy in, I think, the park's history has been the last couple months, Starbucks coming into California Adventure. What's your take on the Starbucks deal?
That should not surprise anyone. It's been talked about for years now. The same people who are upset at that were the people who are upset about McDonald's coming into the parks, and that came and went, and I don't think ruined the Disney experience.
I think actually Starbucks, the fact that they're theming it, the fact that it's not it's branded, but it's not going to be over the top with the branding. The thing I'm hoping is that just like how NASA has impacted so much other technology by spreading its experimentation, I just hope that they can help speed the lines up at the regular Starbucks. They'll find a way to be so efficient on Disney property. I think it's good. It's a little piece of comfort, and I think that people have become so addicted to that. But it's amazing the Twitter outroar on that, the first day was scathing.
Yeah.
And I think it's anytime there's any change, you're going to have the people who grump and gripe about it. But
well, it's anything that makes Disney seem less special.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
And it's something can certainly change, but if it gives people the impression this is not the special place, Disneyland is the anti-world. It's the opposite of the world, and Starbucks is about as world as you can get. So yeah. On the surface, it does create that tension, but when you let it play out, it's nobody's going to die from Starbucks being there.
Well, and you know, having caffeine on Main Street at Maxwell House or Hills Brothers back in the 50s, they ruined it back then.
Exactly the same thing.
Pushing.
It would be interesting if you would open up the Disneyland of 1955 across the street from this Disneyland, but change all the names so people didn't know, and call it the U-Ban Coffee House and the Rite Aid Pharmacy and everything else. People would go nuts, and it would escape them that that's how Disneyland started.
I was a supplier to Imagineering for a while, but before I got hired into the park, and I was talking to one of the Imagineers, and I was talking about ideas for that the third park. I think it's California Adventure was already kind of penned, and I always liked the concept of where the villains hang out. You've got Toontown where the Toons hang out. I guess they were talking about doing a roller coaster themed land in Orlando, originally called Villain's Lair, mm-hmm. where you would have all of the Six Flags style roller coasters in the Villain's Park, because that would be less likely for the little kids to want to go into it anyway. And I thought that was a brilliant idea.
Yeah, there was also the idea to do that as a whole park, but for the reason you just said, I don't know that they'll ever do that. There's talk now, especially with the movie The Avengers opening up
Marvel World.
I've heard people do a Marvel World, and you know what? That would be a great idea for 10% of their audience.
Do you remember the Marvel restaurant at Universal Studios in Hollywood?
For the brief time it was there,
The servers were dressed. I was served by Storm, which was
interesting.
Oh, you
were? Yeah,
that was an interesting experience, so... and we're kind of bringing us to the end of our time, kind of wrapping up. I really, we spent 4 or 5 months playing email tag and all of this. Huge respect for what you've contributed to the Disney community. And, I mean, part of what we wanted to do is, you know, the experience doesn't end when someone leaves the parks. And that has been the case ever since the Disneyland TV show. Mm-hmm. You know, the experience continues, and the internet has made it so that experience can be a little obsessive for some people, but, I mean, you know, the message boards and all that, it's a part of people's daily lives. And, you know, I definitely appreciate what you've contributed to that. You know, I do really think that it was one of the first strikes to build the railroad. You know, it was one of the first shovels of dirt that created where everything's at now, and I just wanted to say thanks and enjoyed sitting down. I'm sure we'll chat more if the off microphone as the days go on.
But. Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you for
so, David. Thank
words.
You so much, guys. Everyone, thanks again for joining us on Tales from the Jungle Cruise. You're our first non-skipper.
Oh,
that we've had.
That's
a kind of a major.
That is. I will. Is there a certificate or something?
Yes, we will get you an induction of the Order of Golden Hippos.
Great.
our ultimate goal, by the way, is I really would like to have John Lasseter on because he is the Uber skipper. Anyway, Kevin Costner, you know, is a Jungle Cruise skipper. It'd be interesting to get him on the show. But no, John Lasseter is kind of my final
big prize.
Guest that I yeah. I figure a couple seasons of this, maybe I can
maybe
send him a nice taping. And so, but once again, thank you so much. Guys, join us on Twitter at SkipCast, where you can be amused by our tales of daring do and by the occasional joke. We do a couple other podcasts on the SkipCast Network. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/SkipCastNetworks. We just launched a new show called Nerd 101, which does a 20-minute insight into a little bit of nerd culture. The Avengers was the first one. Avengers for the non-nerd helped to explain it. So, but thanks for all the support again, as always, everyone. Pass it on to your friends, and thanks for joining us. And Kungaloosh.